This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Sandra Levinson from the Center for Cuban Studies about some of the recent changes in our relationship with Cuba.
Sandy was there on the day of the announcement. We'll hear her describe the joy in the streets of Cuba.
Attorney Lauren Reagan joins us to talk about electronics communication surveillance.
Lauren will tell us that we really have no privacy when it comes to electronic communication, but she will give us some tips about the best we can do in a very surveilled world.
We'll talk with John Prados from the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C., about the aura of secrecy under which the CIA operates.
If you had any doubt that the highest officials in this country approved of the torture regime, he'll lay that doubt to rest.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We'll speak today with Sandra Levinson, the head of the Center for Cuban Studies here in New York City. Sandra Levinson has frequently traveled to Cuba and, in fact, was there on the day where the diplomatic relations were announced by both Raul Castro in Cuba and President Obama here in the United States. We'll get a firsthand report from Sandra Levinson. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Sandra, you were down there 2 weeks ago in Havana when this all happened, Havana or Santiago. Anyway, you were in Cuba. What was it like?
Well, it was incredible. First of all, I was in Santiago de Cuba, and it was the day of St. Lazarus, which, as you probably know, is a very, very important perhaps one of the most sacred days during the year in Cuba. And we had been the night before to a toque de santo and a ceremony and got home about 4 in the morning. And by 8 in the morning, we had the first word that Alan Gross had been freed. And we had absolutely no idea of the breadth, the extent to which Obama would go, really. I mean, I think we were all surprised. I was with my Cuban friends and with the people from the United States who were in my group, and we sat around watching Obama speak because we knew that Raul's speech would be rebroadcast very shortly, and we watched both of them, and really, we were crying. The sirens started in the street. People started shouting because of the return of the three political prisoners, and I think, you know, we spent the day just walking around the streets, talking to everyone, and you cannot imagine how many people said, San Lázaro es muy poderoso, that St. Lazarus is very powerful because he brought about renewed relations between the United States and Cuba. And I think our response was the same as the Cubans. We were shocked. We really were. And, you know, when you've lived through 10 or 11 presidents, and you've seen how bad our policy can be, and also the disappointment that people like me felt since Obama had been elected, that almost nothing had been done except for improving travel for Cuban Americans. I think the point at which I really cried was the point at which he said that we're going to open an embassy in Havana, because once you got over the fact that the three political prisoners were coming home, and that was just sheer joy, to realize, you know, along with the Cubans, and the Cubans we were with were crying too. They said, you know, we've finally been recognized as a government.
Well, there's been an embargo on Cuba for all these years, and I know, Sandra, that you're very much involved with the Cuban art scene. The Center for Cuban Studies has a gallery here in New York City, and you go down there. I don't think I know anybody that's been to Cuba more than you. How is this going to affect that?
Well, I think it's hard to say at this point. I think certainly it will be great, I think, for the Cuban artists, because we've already seen in just the few days that I've been back, we've seen from the calls to the center and from individuals who have been interested in Cuban art, that now they believe, although it's not yet true, they believe that they can simply get on a plane and go down to Cuba and buy Cuban art. I think that, you know, what this will mean for people like us is that we have to be very conscious that a lot of education has to go on about what is good Cuban art, what is this Cuban art, what is self-taught art, what is academic art. I mean, you know, I feel that our job where we are is really to inform people about how great Cuban art is in all its varieties. You know, it's very easy to just go along with the international art market and pick the top ones, you know, without really looking, first of all, beyond Havana, as we always make sure to do. And secondly, to those who are not necessarily trained academically, but are also great artists.
Sandy, I think it's probably going to be months before the full repercussions of all of these developments really sink in. In addition to the jubilation that everyone's feeling now, especially in Cuba, are there any concerns about what the U.S., what kind of policies or things this country might do in the year to come?
Oh, absolutely. You know, by the second day, people were saying, we have to make sure to keep our culture. We have to make sure to keep our country. You know, I mean, I think that certainly people who think at all about this, I mean, I was with the historian and preservationist of the city of Santiago de Cuba, who's very, very, very super smart, loves his city, loves his culture, loves his revolution, and is also excited and happy about the renewal of relations, but is very, very concerned that, you know, that Santiago retains its character, that it's not overrun by tourists, that suddenly there are not all kinds of tourist hotels and tourist infrastructure, that Cuba really takes what it needs from the United States and not what it doesn't need. And for example, in terms of products, I mean, you know, Cuba needs help with its infrastructure. It doesn't need McDonald's. And, you know, our hope is that there are people in place in the Cuban government and in the Cuban municipalities, as I think there are, who are very aware of that and who will do everything possible to prevent that from happening. Everything is not coming up roses. We still have the Helms-Burton law. We still have the embargo. And I think our next fight is to get rid of the Helms-Burton law, because that has done so much to strengthen the embargo.
But of course, Sandy, other than perhaps with the broadest categories of travel, the president has the ability to license every single transaction with Cuba without getting rid of Helms-Burton. I'm not saying he's going to do it, and he hasn't said he would do it. So yeah, sure, we have to fight, but getting rid of it in a double Republican Congress, who knows what the chances are. So in some way, Obama really has to make that fight.
I'm just not sure he's up to doing that. Are you?
No, not at all, yeah. Sandy. Let me ask you a question, because you run trips to Cuba. In fact, some people in this room have been on some of your trips to Cuba, and they're extraordinary, wonderful, amazing trips, and you're going to continue to run them, I know. Have you seen an increase in requests to your office because of people thinking, I better get there before it's too late, whatever that means?
It's already too late, as we all know. No, but what's funny is that people really have the impression that Obama did what Carter did and actually lifted the travel ban, which, of course, he didn't do. And so we're getting calls from people who say, I got an email this morning saying, you know, I'm going to be in Miami March 1st, and we'd like to take a short trip to Cuba in the days following that. Is that possible? And, you know, we've gotten a lot of calls like that. You know, can I just go now? Can I make a reservation on American Airlines? Not yet. You know, we really don't know when or if that will be possible, because the categories are still in place. It's just that now we all travel under the general license instead of specific license. So for the time being, yes, we'll continue arranging our trips. And we're very, very grateful to the president that we will no longer have to write those horrible, horrible reports to OFAC.
At least, I mean, once they change the regulation, you still have to do them as of today, right? You still have to write on each of your trips?
I think not.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
Because you're only supposed to write the report when you're asking for a renewal of the licenses. And since there will be no renewal of licenses, we don't have to do the reports.
Now, I read in the Times already that there's 400,000 Americans go to Cuba a year.
That's legally?
Mostly legally, which is extraordinary. I mean, it's a big number. When you and I went in the old days, there were seven of us.
Yes, right.
So it's actually opened up quite a bit already, in a way.
Yeah, and I think the actual number is closer to a million with all the people who go through third countries.
Right. And they expect 2 or 3 million once this is really more open. Or
so you're
more.
Not supposed to spend money there, and people go there and they spend money and they can be prosecuted for it. But they haven't really been prosecuting people, and I think that's why the numbers are so high.
Yeah, under the Obama administration, people have not been prosecuted or persecuted for travel.
Well, let me ask you about your future, Sandy, and the future of the Center for Cuban Studies. How have things changed for you?
Well, we don't know yet. We really don't know. I mean, I think what we have to do is put our programs in place as best as possible and wait for the OFAC regulations to come out. I think that it will be, since it will be so much easier for people to travel on their own, I hope, perhaps we won't have to go to Cuba as often as we do now, leading groups of people, but instead can simply offer our services to people who want to travel on their own. We don't know also what Cuba's response will be to that. I think that the Cubans will attempt to slow the flow of people from the United States to what they can manage. You know, as we all know, the infrastructure for tourism is not sufficient at this point to take care of everyone. I think that, you know, for myself, I hope I can teach people more about Cuban art.
Let me, if I might, ask you a personal question, because I know that you've been involved with the center. Really the main person and the reason the center exists is because of Sandy Levinson. And you've been involved with Cuba going all the way back. What's your story about this? How did you get involved with the Cuban Revolution?
Don't say it's a guy, please.
Oh, no. I think, you know, if you were a political person in the 60s, you got involved with Cuba, right?
You were on the 1st Brigade, right?
No, I wasn't on the 1st Brigade, but I was one of the organizers of the 1st Brigade.
1961
or
1969. 69. Okay. Did you cut cane with Fidel?
I did. And that was before the Vince Ramos Brigade. That was on my very first trip.
When you cut cane with Fidel, you know, we had Michael Krinsky on here before, and he didn't give his story, but, you know, his partners, when he joined the firm, Victor Rabinowitz and Leonard Boudin, used to play chess with Che. But because it was their client, they would always have to lose the game, even though Leonard, I think, felt he could beat Che. So the question for you with Fidel, when you cut cane, did you hold back your cutting ability so that Fidel would cut more cane than you did?
I certainly did not. Are you kidding? My goal was to at least be competitive. But of course, I was hit by a sugar cane in my back, and that put the end to my cane cutting abilities.
What were your hopes then when you got involved with the Cuban Revolution? And what do you think now?
Well, I mean, my hopes then, and certainly when we started the center in 1972, was that we would help build bridges sufficient to lead to the normalization of relations. I don't think we've reached the normalization of relations yet, as long as we have, you know, legislation like Helms-Burton in place. But it is good. It's a good feeling after 42 years to at least see the Cuban government recognized. And, you know, I mean, I got involved for all of the political reasons that people did get involved in the 60s. You know, the injustice with which we treated the Cuban Revolution was horrifying to me. I mean, you know, for people like us in the 60s, we thought this was or could be the wave of the future, especially if we helped. I never thought there would be so much opposition in our own government.
Speaking of government, Sandy, as we look to the future post the Obama administration, how do you think this will impact Obama's overall legacy and how he is remembered historically?
Well, I think he now has a chance to be remembered as a better president than he did before, without a doubt. I mean, you know, if I can say it on the air, it's as though he finally found his balls. I mean, that's what we were saying in Cuba, and I think it's true. You know, it's good to see that he perhaps remembers what he started out trying to do.
Use the word cojones, right?
Yes, cojones, exactly. He finally found his cojones. And we all know that Hillary used that term once, too.
It's also true, though, and this is what the American government has recognized, that their policy of isolating Cuba didn't work. And their intention of reversing the aspects of the Cuban Socialist Revolution that they hated and the example that Cuba was showing didn't work. I wouldn't attribute great altruistic motives to either
Not
Obama
at all. This is dropping refrigerators on the Soviet Union. Remember when we used to say that that was the U.S. government policy? I'm just surprised that they didn't do it sooner, that they didn't recognize sooner.
Right, because your point, Michael, is right, except that's been true for 45 years. Certainly the last 25, they should have recognized it completely, yeah. And they didn't. So something else is going on. Whatever reasons, either the generation in Miami is old enough so that it doesn't have the power and the clout so that they could do what they may think is really their way of undermining what's going on in Cuba. I mean, who knows?
And I think, you know, when Hillary's book came out and she said that she had tried to urge Obama to end the embargo because of our relationship with Latin America, clearly it's because of U.S. interest that we are doing this. I mean, we are not doing it to finally be nice to the Cuban Revolution. We are doing it because so many years have gone by and all of the Latin American countries have made clear, as has the rest of the world, that they think our policy stinks.
Yeah, I'll say.
You know?
The vote at the UN for 22 years condemned it, and last vote was 188-2. Israel and the United States were the two.
And Israel is the second biggest trading partner after Spain with Cuba.
Yes.
Let's just say this. So that vote has a lot of meaning that the U.S. picked up Israel.
But I think that there are commercial interests in the United States that really do want to sell stuff to Cuba.
Absolutely.
Cuba, which originally was isolated by the United States, managed to get to a position where the United States was isolated. So the next summit of the Americas that's coming up, the countries in South America and Central America said to the United States, we don't care if you come or not, but we're inviting Cuba. So the United States found itself out in the cold. I think that there were both economic and political reasons.
Yes, and that was one reason.
Policy.
That was one reason why many of us have been saying that if something isn't done before, that something has to be done before April when that meeting is held, because otherwise the meeting would be a disaster.
Give us the website for the Center for Cuban Studies. We want people to learn how they can get a hold of your organization.
Yes, please. CubaUpdate.org and CubanArtSpace.net. And we're open 11 to 7 Monday through Friday and 12 to 6 on Saturdays. So basically we're there a lot of hours and you can come by all the time.
A number of years ago, your office was around the corner from my house in the West Village.
Yes.
And as I recall, your office was bombed. Is that right?
That is true.
Cuba, I live next door. I remember.
That is the Cuban exile. The Cuban exile put a huge plastic bomb in the center with me in it and blew the whole place up. So, you know, yes, I was the talk of our neighborhood for a while. But I survived, as you can see.
What year was that?
That was 1973, March of 1973.
Well, I didn't realize you were in the
Oh, yes. The whole place blew up except where I was sitting.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Wow.
I won't tell you what I was thinking.
So really, we took a risk here having you on the program, Sandy Levinson. But we thank you.
We're glad you survived.
Thank you. I am too.
Thank you, Sandy.
National Lawyers Guild attorney Lauren Reagan is executive director and staff attorney of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon. She has recently had published an article titled Electronic Communication Surveillance in the special double issue of Monthly Review. The issue is called Surveillance Capitalism. It has a number of articles on that topic, including an article by Alfred W. McCoy, who we have interviewed on this show, and also by Michael Tiger, who we've also interviewed about the topic of their article. We turn now to Lauren Reagan's article. She talks about how the government spies on us, what they know about us, and how we can defend ourselves, if only minimally.
Lauren Reagan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Lauren, we came across your really provocative article in a monthly review. The article is titled Electronic Communication Surveillance. And there's a lot I took away from that article, but I think one of the most stunning opening questions for me is when you ask early on in the article, how much privacy do we actually have? And so my first question to you is, Lauren, how much privacy do we actually have?
Not a whole lot, I'd have to say, unfortunately. So corporations that are engaged in gray intelligence, you know, in corporate spying, use the term threat assessment. They look at activist communities or even individuals, and they determine what level of threat they pose to the profit-making, you know, components of their enterprise. And I think it's important for activists to sort of engage in their own threat assessment as well. Obviously, someone who is leafleting on a street corner, to lower taxes is probably going to have a lesser threat than the Earth Liberation Front press person. The first thing I would say is one size does not fit all with regard to threats to your privacy by either the government or corporations.
Lauren, in your article, you mentioned something that I thought was not usually spoken about, but that we've seen from things like passage of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and that is that often private security firms who are retained to monitor or infiltrate activist groups, often this happens in conjunction with public relations components or firms. How does that play out?
Right. So we found this information out with regard to some public records requests. In the documents, we learned that the industries or the corporations themselves want to maintain clean hands, and they don't want to get caught illegally spying on mom and pop who are out holding a banner on a street corner. And so they've sort of devised this scheme where there is a security firm and a public relations firm that kind of open up their own shop next door, sometimes literally the very next building or the very next office suite. And the surveillance aspect of it, they're often former FBI agents for some of these big corporations and industries. They will go out and collect the intelligence, and it's up to the PR firm to put it into these, you know, quote-unquote terrorist bulletins. This has gone on for quite some time, but I think it's somewhat new. It has gotten this type of exposure. You know, for a long time, we knew that corporations, often hired by the government itself, but also often hired by, you know, by big industry, have been going through open source intelligence. So they've been monitoring our websites and social media and email lists and press releases and any other public documents that they can get their hands on in their, you know, 8-hour paid day. And they compile all this information into reports, and then they sell it to police or other corporations or the government. And they call them, you know, issue monitoring or trend analysis. But in essence, it is attempting to, you know, both legitimize and make profit off of spying on political groups and political activists.
Well, I know that one such PR firm is Diesenhall Resources that I believe worked and continues to work closely with the government. And one of the things they help do is vilify, say, animal rights activists through print and media public relations campaigns.
That's right. In my experience, it's less important to focus on the name of the corporation because they are so slippery and constantly changing their names that, you know, the evildoer today just changes their name to something else tomorrow. But yes, you're right, you know, everything from the ag-gag issues that are taking place around the country to some very targeted surveillance of vegan potlucks, the animal rights movement has definitely been a significant target for this type of spying. And I think coming very close on the heels of that movement is the targeting of climate justice activists, you know, those that are engaged in often above-ground activism against coal and fracking and clean water and pipelines and, you know, all of these other issues that have made it onto the front page of, you know, many news stories lately.
We're speaking with Lauren Regan,
author of an article on called Electronic Communication Surveillance. It's in the July-August issue of Monthly Review and available online. We'll give you the link for that. And I think when talking about climate change, that's movement. That is one area you worked on in your article. Can you go into that a little bit more of how that's working? Because you did spend a few pages in the article on that issue.
Sure. Yeah. So this article came out in the summer, which is often our busy time period. That is where a lot of action campaigns are very, very prolific in their public outreach activities, let's say. It was important to come out with this article in a timely way because I'm sure as you and all your listeners know, you know, what is cutting edge today will literally be almost obsolete, you know, in a few days or a few weeks in terms of electronic communication surveillance. So it's a constant changing universe, but I think it's important to try and get as, you know, as up-to-date information in the hands of activists as possible. We had been working with a number of different organizations around the country who were afraid, who were thinking about stopping their campaigns and going back to the couch and the television because they were concerned that they were going to be put in prison, that they were going to be labeled terrorists, that the government was coming after them, et cetera, because of these antics, I guess I would say, by different corporations in spying on them. One of the campaigns out of Pennsylvania, you know, consisted of teachers and doctors and people who were once a week going out on the street corner and holding a banner opposing fracking. And they found themselves in a terrorist bulletin that had been subject of a public records request. That type of activity, even though it was not done by our government, it was provided to the government and potentially at the behest of the government. But nonetheless, you know, I think most Americans are deeply concerned with the amount of surveillance going on right now and are concerned about the whims of the government concocting new, quote-unquote, terrorists. You know, I think Heidi's example of the animal rights movement is a perfect example. You know, the idea that you know, someone engaged in you know, animal rights activism or a boycott on a fur farm or a feedlot could somehow be prosecuted for a terrorist crime is chilling to a lot of people. You know, I think obviously the best tactic to utilize in opposition of that is to not allow yourself to be chilled and to not allow these tactics to be successful, because of course then the government is only reinforced in using them against activists of all stripes. But, you know, I think there are a lot of people that, you know, see that as an incredible threat to their personal safety and their jobs and their family and everything else like that. And especially when you're talking about giant coal industries and the tar sands industries. You know, these are gazillion-dollar corporations. They are multinational in scope. They are, you know, working together within their industries, which means they have more money and resources to put, you know, roadblocks in the way of regular old public interest citizens than ever before. And, you know, oftentimes when I'm talking to groups, I tell them, you know, despite all of this money and all of this activity being focused on trying to thwart their efforts, the climate justice movement, you know, or the animal rights movement have been quite successful in empowering others and in getting their message out and really kind of changing the dialogue in the U.S. So, you know, despite all of the bazillions of dollars being spent and, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of full-time staff people who are paid to attempt to mess with these campaigns, the campaigns catch on and they are often, you know, successful in their own communities. Who knows how much more successful they could be without these types of obstacles being put in their way.
I'm glad you're stressing that because, of course, what you write about is very scary. And to say that people aren't being intimidated, that you're giving the message not to be intimidated, that we're actually doing pretty well, I think is important. I want to turn you to another part of the article that you did. And what you say here is it's called protecting yourself.
And you say you don't really have any privacy when it comes to electronic communication. There are no absolute protections in electronic communication. Your cell phone, email, social media, and any other form of communication are subject to surveillance. And then you talk about some ways to protect yourself against the NSA. And as you put in your note, there's no way to get absolute protections. And can you just, in a non-technical way, I want our listeners to understand there are things they can do to protect their electronic communications. The first thing you mentioned there is browse the internet with Tor or through a virtual private network. What does that mean?
Well, yes, there are some things that you can do to make life more difficult for those that wish to spy upon you. And again, you know, these tools change rapidly. And I would direct people to check out EFF.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They specialize in monitoring technology and surveillance. But Tor and VPNs are a way to search the internet and or use the internet with less ability to be tracked or surveyed, especially when their activism may include outside of the U.S. Tor networks can be helpful. But a tool like this is only as strong as the creator of the tool. If a creator receives a subpoena, if the government, you know, issues warrants against the creators, there have been situations where the creators have given backdoor access to the government or have been forced to turn over records, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, you know, using entities like RiseUp.net or Tor or these VPNs, you know, it's something. But, you know, I think the tried and true piece of advice that most tech people will give you with regard to security is, you know, that face-to-face conversation is still the most secure, you know, way to organize and to have private conversations. And anything that you do over the internet will add an additional risk. And you really need to evaluate, you know, how high is that risk? How bad are the consequences if the government does survey that, you know, that communication? Take as many steps as you can with regard to your own threat assessment, as I mentioned at the beginning. And there are a lot of good resources on the internet that are trusted, like EFF and RiseUp, that people should consult regularly with.
Lauren, tell us briefly about your work at the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Oregon.
Sure. We focus on working with activist communities to make sure that they have up-to-date information about what their rights are when they're engaging in dissent. We also represent activists for free, and we coordinate legal teams around the country to ensure that activists have very high-quality representation when they choose to risk their liberty for a cause. We also help marginalized communities who are dealing with police harassment or racial profiling. We do a lot of federal police misconduct and government cases. And more, we are taking on a lot of FOIA and public records cases as we try to sort of go down this long tunnel trying to figure out how current surveillance tactics with regard to government and corporate surveillance are operating on activist communities.
And if people would like to get a hold of your article in the monthly review, what's the link for that?
Our website is cldc.org. And if you put in CLDC and electronic surveillance, I'm pretty sure it will take you straight to that link.
Great. Lauren, thank you so much for being
a
guest with us.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for the great article, Lauren.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We'll be right back.
Surveillance and torture programs conducted by agents and contractors of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has a storied past. One of the first revelations of the CIA's illegal activities released to the public was in December 1974 by the New York Times. Then, details of surveillance, eavesdropping, detention, and interrogation shocked readers. It was also the foundation for research by our next guest, John Prados, senior fellow at the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the book, The Family Jewels, The CIA, Secrecy, and Presidential Power, in which he recounts covert operations and how Vice President Richard Cheney played a leading role in intelligence abuses. John Prados joins us today to talk about the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence torture report in the larger context of his research. Welcome, John, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you work at the National Security Archive, which is a public interest group working for open government. And I understand that in June 2007, you got a package in the mail. What was in that package?
It was a semi-notorious CIA document that was known as the Family Jewels. This was a record of CIA abuses of the 1950s and 60s and 70s when they were spying on American citizens. And in fact, that the news of that, the revelation that that had happened, was so explosive at that time that it led to multiple investigations of the CIA by the Church Committee, the Pike Committee, and a presidential commission headed by Nelson Rockefeller, who was then the Vice President of the United States.
That was the so-called Year of Intelligence.
Yes, that's right.
Talk to us a bit about avoidance of scrutiny and the general mindset of the CIA.
I think that the CIA has a preoccupation with image. The episode of the Family Jewels is typical, actually, because at the time, the intelligence agency's director was Michael Hayden, and Hayden, simultaneous with the declassification of that document, for which, by the way, we had been waiting for almost two decades. Simultaneous with the release of that document, Hayden went out and made a speech taking credit for thinking of releasing the Family Jewels themselves, as if this were an initiative that had been taken at the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency, rather than their legally required response to a Freedom of Information Act request. I have to tell you that I believe that the same kind of thing continues to happen. In my book, The Family Jewels, I have a couple of chapters that document this kind of activity. But what I really want to get to is the Senate torture report, because I believe that the exact same kind of activity is intimately evolved and laced through all of the action that has taken place with this Senate report.
That was going to be actually my next question to you. This is Michael Ratner, John. Because you're an expert in this area. You've studied the CIA for years. You know it historically. And the first question, I guess, is what was your reaction and did it surprise you?
I am not surprised. I am scandalized by the Senate Intelligence Committee's report, but I am not surprised. I have been expecting that this report will say exactly this, and I've been writing about how the Central Intelligence Agency has been delaying action on this as a means of covering itself, and I believe that that exact thing happened here. You know, we have been waiting for now 2 years for the appearance of this report. And the current director of the CIA, John Brennan, took office promising to release this report and then sat on it for another 18 months. And the report comes out and you see it's got many, many, many deletions in it. Well, if you look at the website that's maintained by former Director Hayden and former Director Porter Goss and former Director George Tenet, you will see that they have posted on their website declassified CIA documents much more lightly redacted that were released as long ago as last summer, then into September, and some of them even a few days ago in December, just before the release of the Senate report itself. In other words, the CIA, oh, and by the way, this included a specific work product, i.e. studies by the Center for the Study of Intelligence about CIA notifications to Congress on torture. In other words, the agency declassified to its own former employees people for documents for a website to discredit the Senate report before it released the Senate report, and in time for those people to write material around these declassified CIA documents that they could post on the web instantaneously when the report went out.
Interesting. So they were doing a sort of preemptive damage control.
That's right. And they were doing this with U.S. secrecy laws, manipulating U.S. secrecy laws in order to do this.
By declassifying certain documents.
That's correct.
Some
very interesting documents, by the way. Let me tell you, these are the first documents I have seen that contain direct White House action and activity on the torture issue.
When you say that, you mean to say approvals of certain techniques or the broad program? Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Oh, no. The best piece of this is it relates to early 2004, where there was the United Nations International Day of Support for Victims of Torture. And the Bush White House released a statement that said, you know, the White House supports this. We issued an order in February 2002 for the humane treatment of prisoners, blah, 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 which the CIA immediately took as questioning its authorities and permissions to go ahead with torture because it was so sensitive on this issue. And Tenet sends a memo to Condi Rice and requests that the White House reconfirm Bush administration's support for the torture program. And when that was not immediately forthcoming, they did this again. And there's a pattern of activity that goes on from, I would say, about February of 2004 till July, in which first a Department of Justice person says that the DOJ had not taken a written position on the subject of some of the CIA's torture techniques. And Tenet takes that as a reconfirmation of this question mark, so he sends more memos to Condi Rice, and then they have a principals meeting at the White House. And those Tenet memos and a memcon of that principals meeting and the CIA briefing to that principals meeting and Tenet's talking points for that meeting are all part of this document release.
Now tell me what, because I saw, tell me the name of the website again. It's like Can Save the CIA or something. I don't remember.
CIASavedLives.com.
That's it, CIASavedLives.com. So this is amazing because this is on the website basically saying the fact that you put out a statement, a lie, about how you love the fact that there's a no torture day in the world, the UN no torture day. We're worried about it at the CIA. So reconfirm that you're allowing us to torture. That's essentially what they're asking.
That's correct. And these things were released as part of the argument that's made by the former intelligence officials that torture was approved and legal.
Right. Now, do you in your own mind have any question that the Principals Committee, which is, I guess, the heads of a number of the cabinet posts, and any question that they approved this program?
Oh, no question. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the record of the principals meeting here where they're reconfirming says that some combination, that's a quote, of Condi Rice, Alberto Gonzalez, and Mr. Cheney will privately inform Mr. Bush that, CIA is continuing with these methods and that they may be controversial.
Are you saying that's in these documents that are up on this site? That's extraordinary.
Yes, it is.
I mean, how come none of our media, our major media, has picked this up? I mean, I was aware of that website, and I thought, oh, it's going to be a BS website. I'm not going to visit the website. And they basically, what you're saying, they declassified documents that essentially implicate the principals committee in approving their techniques.
That's correct.
And do you have a, have you seen this reported other than in your own voice or reporting, reported anywhere of any, that anybody would read it?
Well, I was about to do a post either for my website or for History Newsnet, but no, I have not seen anyone pick this up. And I may be actually giving this all away right here.
And now we can visit the website
right.
at least. Oh, my
now,
gosh.
Now, John, when you've gone to this website, has anything surprised you since you are so immersed in this topic?
I would say that the thing that surprised me most about their website is how well organized they were about doing this. In the last days before the release of the Senate report, I saw a statement from John McLaughlin, the former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who mentioned that, oh, well, when they release the report, we're going to be doing some other things. We're going to put out some other stuff. And I believe he used the word documents. So I was interested in seeing what kind of evidence they had to offer. But when I went to their website, I saw that what they had was, you know, there's a drop-down menu with not one, but dozens of different media appearances by various combinations of them. And then there's another piece of it that's about legality and another piece about this. A very sophisticated website, which clearly took much designing to prepare.
Now, you've written, I think, in the introduction to the Family Jewels that the true damage to the nation is wrought by the operations themselves and by efforts to evade investigation.
Exactly right.
Right.
I still believe that.
Right. And this would seem to be part of that, that there's so much effort going into, as you say, preserving image to avoid, I guess, public embarrassment. The CIA will go to any number of efforts to protect that image and keep things secret.
Well, this episode that we're discussing here right now, where in early 2004 the CIA erupts because there's suddenly some indication that maybe everyone's not on board for their torture program, I would say that's prime evidence of exactly that phenomena in action.
Damage control, as it were.
Yes. Well, not just damage control, but the perpetrators, the agency officials who are responsible for this program, they know it's not legal. They know it's morally reprehensible. So they are operating under the fig leaf of this presidential authority and this mumbo-jumbo Department of Justice legal memo network. And if there's a breath of questioning of it, all of a sudden, they're not covered anymore. That's the reason for the sensitivity, and that's the reason why the CIA suddenly erupted in this effort to reconfirm the authorities.
John, I was disturbed to read that 50% of the Americans say it's wrong in a recent poll for the Senate Intelligence Committee to issue a report saying otherwise, in terms of the CIA actions being resulting in fruitful intelligence. That, to me, speaks to the fact the CIA and others have done a very good job in their public relations campaign.
Yes, I think that the ABC Washington Post poll is disturbing, but I'm also drawing a bit of comfort from it because what it really does say is that this is all about the image-making. According to that poll, 54% of Americans believe that the CIA misled the White House, Congress, and the public about its activities. They divide over whether it was justified or unjustified that the CIA did this, but the majority believe that the CIA engaged in misleading. And the 84% concerns whether or not the CIA uncovered information that was useful. Well, if you delete material from the documents in such a way that the public can't tell that the material that the CIA claims it got was useful, and then you've deleted documents in a way that the public can't tell whether the CIA is misleading everybody, what you have basically done is create circumstances in which the public can't tell what's going on. And rulemaking and regulation, which is at the heart of the American system, can't take place under those circumstances.
John, I have a question about differences historically on what we're seeing today. One of the differences I've heard people mention, and I thought myself, is, you know, the work you've done, the work others have done on what School of the Americas, on the torture that went on in Central America. Brazil just came out with a statement, Dilma, about how the techniques used against her when she was captured as a young woman, those were also taught in the School of the Americas. 300 of her general or her military people were trained at School of the Americas. CIA was deeply involved. They had torture manuals, etc. So the CIA is obviously quite a history on this. But is it one of the differences that this was openly and publicly approved and bragged about by the last administration? Is there something different about that? Is there something that we're seeing that's different than what we saw before?
I definitely think there's a difference in scale. And I also think that there is there's a difference in the centrality of this in terms of American policy. You know, in the 1960s and the 1970s and the 80s, when it was about communism and it was about enemies in Central America and whatnot, the torture programs were part of a package of techniques that was intended to combat the adversary. In the present period, in the period of the so-called global war on terror, the torture became the center of the activity because without the information that they obtained, there was no military action. There was no other action independent of what they could establish by means of their intelligence. Now, here's the thing. The Senate report is so important because it really shows that on all of these cases, they took the 20 ones where the CIA most claims that were they got information for them. The Senate report shows that in every one of those cases, in fact, they were getting information without resorting to the torture. And this is where the public relations comes in, and this is where the ABC Washington Post poll gets it wrong, because the public is not able to appreciate the degree to which the information actually was obtainable other than by torture.
John, is there a chance of prosecution in the U.S.? I work on them in Europe. We tried the U.S. What's going to be the result of this? Is it going to be business as usual in this country? Are we going to get some changes?
Well, let me put it this way. If I were any of these people, I would be hesitant about traveling anywhere outside of borders of the United States. You know, the Malaysia issue of the trials in absentia has already gone against former President Bush and some of his officials. And I do believe that the European Union rules and regulations on this are further advanced than ours, and they're more serious about enforcing them. So I wouldn't want to go there. Maybe if you wanted to travel to Latin America or Africa, you could get away with it. But that's facetious. Let me answer your larger question. I think we have a challenge. I think that we need to work to make a wedge for accountability in this country. And I do think that Americans are shamed and embarrassed by this behavior. This is not what the United States is about. The first order of business is to get proper information before the American people. And the next order of business is to restructure the regulatory system. It has to be there have to be changes in the way that intelligence activities are overseen and managed from the public policy standpoint. I believe that this episode shows that the oversight system, as we conventionally understand it, is no longer capable of managing properly the intelligence activities of the country.
John, before we leave you, speak briefly, if you will, about the work of the National Security Archive.
Well, absolutely. We are dedicated to accountability, one document at a time, as we like to put it. What we do is we try and work to make the secret records of the United States government available to Americans, scholars, citizens, anyone who's interested in using them. And we do that by subject. We have people like me who work in different subject fields, and each of us follows those areas and puts in requests and tries to open up information and brings together information in a way that Americans or any scholar could use it. And we make this available on our website, at our offices, and also in a large electronic document base that's machine searchable, and it's accessible in many colleges and universities in the country. When you're looking at the paper and you see in there some story that a document has been released that shows such and such a thing, 9 times out of 10, actually, that's part of the work of the National Security Archive, in my opinion. There are many others make use of the Freedom of Information Act, but I think we do more than almost anyone I can think of.
And what a wonderful service you do provide. John, it's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
We hope to talk to you again.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate your work. It's great.
Thank you. I'm honored.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.